What's up? It's Marcus. And just a quick note, Create and Orchestrate is live. You can get it today at Amazon, and for a very short period of time, it is available for 99 cents on the Kindle. So that is a complete steal. Go grab it today if you haven't already. And also, I'm selling signed copies as well as commemorative t-shirts for the launch at my own e-commerce store, creativepower.co. That's creativepower.co. So go get it today. And now for the episode of Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.
This is Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.
Like, you got to do the work. You got to show up and just do the work.
What's up? What's up? Another episode of Marcus Whitney Live. I'm excited. I am introducing someone to the universe today who really feels like I probably should have known, because I have so many connections to her in my life. One connection is through Nexus, a group I'm involved with that's all around impact investing and social entrepreneurship. Another one is a really good friend of mine here in Nashville. And probably the most important one is a dude who I grew up with in Brooklyn. We were in Jack and Jill in Brooklyn together, and actually went to the same college together. And so, like, when I was referred to her as someone who would be a great guest for the show, I looked at her name. I was like, yo, I think I know who this is. And then on email, we confirmed she is, in fact, married to my friend Hank, who was like my childhood friend, which is crazy. And man, I just spent 10 minutes just learning about everything that she's into, an incredible background. I'm really excited to talk to her more about everything that she's doing from a law perspective, from an entrepreneurship perspective, and from an investing perspective. So without any further ado, welcome to the show, Candace S. Cook. Candace, what's good?
Hi, how are you, Marcus? Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to jump into this conversation. You are doing some really, really innovative things in the practice of law. Your mindset, the way that you're going after this, just tenacious energy, just very, very entrepreneurial. So why don't we just start with a little bit of background of how you got into the practice of law, and help us to understand why you've taken such an entrepreneurial angle with it.
My goodness. Okay. So I've been practicing law for so long, I'm almost at a loss as to how I stumbled into it. I really feel that as a child, unfortunately, so to my detriment, I saw very pigeonholed silos of success and what success looked like. And a lot of that was influenced from media. So in my life, or from surroundings, right? So obviously your friends and your family in certain instances give you that glimpse, but then they also tend to influence what your mindset is in terms of what you're going to do. And in my household, my mom was very big on either a STEM career before it was expected to be into a STEM career, and or law. But I remember in maybe second grade saying I wanted to be a lawyer, and my mom said, you're not going to be a lawyer. There are too many lawyers in the world. You need a career where you'll be in demand. It was the second grade. And wow. So I shifted my mind because she was like, you're going to be a chemical engineer. And so my focus was on math and science for a very long time. And anyone who knows me is probably spitting out their drink right now. Not from the science part, because I'm still very much so. I really did truly love science and still do. But the math part, I mean, I went to, you know, math camp on Saturday mornings and space camp and all of that. Long story short, when I got into college, the classes that spoke to me were really the ones that were traditionally for people who thought pre-law was not a major, but it was sort of that trajectory. And so I had a professor who essentially said, I just don't understand. I was pre-med at that time.
Okay.
I don't understand why you don't want to be a lawyer. And I thought about it. I'm like, I don't really know why I don't want to be a lawyer either. That was, you know, years ago that my mom sort of, what happened to a dream deferred me. And so I changed my mind and decided that that was the field that I wanted to go into and sort of focused on that. And I stumbled into litigation. I really, again, media influenced it. What I saw in terms of what I was exposed to were litigators. Mm. And so I became a corporate litigator first. And after doing that for a while, it was very much though trial by fire. And I'm grateful for that experience. But what ended up happening during my time as a corporate litigator was social media started to take off. And when I say social media, I really am referencing Twitter, because things like Facebook really were not only in their fledgling period, but they legitimately were being used by college students within the schools to communicate with each other. They had not pierced sort of this third veil of, or third wall of users. And so I remember part of, and this just shows, it's a whole show about sort of, you know, the practice. I worked at a very traditional corporate law firm. And so if you wanted time with the partner, you would get your shoes shined together. That's a real thing. And so, and it was a big deal for you to be invited, because it essentially meant he wanted to have time with you and was willing to hear what your insights were. And so I got a call. His office and the office of his, the other named partner, was called The Kingdom. And I got a call that I was invited to The Kingdom and to go get my shoes shined. Wow. And so we went to go get our shoes shined, and he asked me what were things that were on my mind in terms of the firm. And I asked about our social media policy and what they were going to do about it in terms of employee engagement. And I remember his question was, what do you mean and what are you referencing? And it was at that very specific moment in time that I realized this was the one area where there was going to be no learning curve compared to my competition, because we were all going to know the same thing at the same time. And that meant entrepreneurs who were on social media, what the laws were going to look like, who was going to be able to measure what was foreseeable and what wasn't. No one was going to understand and gauge it better than I could, because we were all in it together. And it was at that exact moment that I realized I needed to not be in corporate litigation, because that's what happens when everything goes wrong. And I want to be on the front side of the deals. And so that was it.
I love that story. That is such a great story. So, okay. I love that story, because that period of time for me was very transformational as well. I was at South by Southwest 2007, and I had spent the previous 3.5 years as a programmer building an email marketing platform. And it was really cool. You know, it was 2003 to 2007. But I remember being there and getting one of those early Twitter accounts and watching Twitter influenced this entire conference of then probably under 2,000 people, right, who were attending. But the 2,000 people were Zuckerberg and Gary Vaynerchuk, and you know, it was like it was kind of crazy. And just leaving there thinking, oh my God, the world is totally going to change, and nobody is ready for it. You know what I mean? Yep. And so, like, you know, like your conversation in the kingdom, getting your shoes signed with the senior partner, feels like your moment like that.
That's it. No, absolutely. And the thing is, it's like watching the world shift with everyone and realizing everyone doesn't, we all can't feel it, right? And so we're all not paying attention. And for too many, by the time you're paying attention, it's too late.
Right.
And right. I did not want, I mean, I feel like so much of that is happening with cryptocurrency and blockchain. And these are all things that right now are outside of our realm of every single, for many people, outside of the realm of everyday conversation. The problem is, by the time it's a part of our everyday conversation, we have not played a role in shaping or crafting it. And that's what shifted my mind and made me say, I can't just be doing traditional things. We don't live in a traditional world anymore. We live in a world that is constantly, you know, we talk about iteration for entrepreneurs, but the world is iterating at a steady pace. And so we're either going to play a role in how that's shaped, or we're going to have to deal with what's given to us. And we're not going to like what we get. And we can see it now, right? And by the time we start making noise, there's so many other factors that have to be in play that are outside of our control, when we could control a few of these variables in the very beginning. And so that's where I am.
So as an entrepreneur, one thing I've learned is the importance of a great lawyer. And to define a great lawyer, I would say it is really hard to find an innovative, offense-oriented lawyer, right? Most of them are in the business of risk management. And I love that part of it, right? Because I love that they are allowing me to sort of be flying fast and just making sure I'm understanding the ramifications of my decisions. But occasionally, it really would be helpful to have a lawyer that was a thought partner and how to be, you know, how to structure a deal from a long-term thinking perspective that's not entirely risk-oriented, but is like upside-oriented and is seeing things on the front end and thinking about the growth potential. From that conversation that you had and when you realized you needed to move out of litigation and into something that was going to be, you know, a level playing field, did you immediately know that you needed to have an entrepreneurial edge to what you were doing? Or did you just think, hey, I want to be on the ground floor writing social media policies? Like how what was the leap from there to sort of where you are now in your thinking?
I think you don't know what you don't know. Right. And so I knew that I wanted to shift and get on the front side of the deals, but it wasn't until I did a sabbatical, and I did that sabbatical at Stanford through their Graduate School of Business. And that program was focused on entrepreneurs. And I was a lawyer, right? They really mm-hmm. were looking for engineers and people who were passionate about product design, but I pitched an idea and I got accepted. And it was in that program that I realized how trained against entrepreneurs attorneys are and yes. how the way we do business, it was only sitting on the other side, but never being able to take my lawyer hat off, that I realized, oh my God, if this is how the deals are done, because I was sitting in meetings where we were using, you know, I was put in a group with a scientist who is essentially using nanotechnology to address cancer. And we were pitching it and, you know, getting $5 million, you know, off pitching for $5 million checks, you know, small rounds in the real world. Mm-hmm. But that was what we were working on. And as I sat there and saw in practice how things were done, there were two things that I realized. One, lawyers for the most part are getting it wrong. There's some who were getting it right at that time. I mean, this was a long time ago, but there were some who were getting it right, but not enough. Mm-hmm. And two, the coasts matter, right? So how things and how money flows and how deals are accepted and discussed and measured and scaled on the West Coast is significantly different than how it's done on the East Coast. And I don't think I realized the play-by-play until I did that. And so when I saw those things, it helped shape how I was going to build and craft and create my business mm-hmm. and also how I would target different clients and customers and consumers and partners that I wanted to work with based on those differences and what I could offer that others couldn't or didn't realize they should be offering at that time. And more importantly, what I didn't want to do. Right. A lot of the really innovative attorneys, I don't want to paint this picture, I was the first to do it. It's just at the time, I was the first in my age bracket to do it. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot that had done it before, but it gotten burned by the bubble bursting.
Right.
And so people had bought into this whole new things are coming. Technology is the way. And then we had, you know, it wasn't the recession that was to come in sort of that 2008, 2010 period. But in 2002, 2003, that time period, the West Coast had really been hit. And so you had a lot of lawyers who just said never again. And so they got away from trusting that brave idea, let's do a new frontier thing, because they thought, and they had witnessed it go wrong. For me, I felt that, yeah, it could go wrong. But, you know, someone once told me after a hit happens and there was a huge success and they kept referring to that one success of mine. And I said, you know, I'm doing a lot more than just that. And he looked at me and he said, but that's the thing about a great success is you don't have to keep doing it. Like, that's it. You want the win. Like, you've won, like, take that and use that for all it's worth, because you need the one to build. And so because a lot of people had been in their fledgling part of their career, never got that win in the tech space, then they didn't want to do it anymore. And yeah. I didn't have that experience. Yep. I sort of part of it was naivete, and the other part was I'm going back to New York, so I'm not going to be trying to give away people's social security numbers, which is, you know, something I heard pitched in California. Like, it was a very different out of the box way of thinking, whereas New York is close to the stock exchange. They still want to know how you're monetizing the business. They want to see some level of return. And so, yeah, that's what shifted it. And that's sort of what brought me to that mindset.
So when you came back from sabbatical, you came back from this Stanford experience, you've learned about the differences in the coast, a completely different way of thinking. Most lawyers are getting it wrong. Do you start your own practice at that point?
I do.
Wow.
I do. And that was predicated off of, I feel that for a lot of entrepreneurs, you do a dance, right? Mm-hmm. So I was doing, and the dance, to finish the thought, is you want to start your own business, or you have this idea that you want to do, but you're very used to security and safety. And so you'll also do your main gig. And so it's this idea of, I want my real job, in air quotes, and then I'll see what happens with this other piece. And I was being offered very dynamic roles in terms of name and money and prestige, but they weren't the things I wanted to do, because people want to hire you based off of what you've done and not what you're coming and saying you want to do. And I was complaining to my dad, I don't want to do that. That's what I've already done. And my dad's thought process was, no one needs to hire you to do what you want to do. They're hiring you to do what they need you to do.
Yep.
If you want to do your own thing, then you need to start your own thing or stop complaining. That was really his position. And I did not want, truthfully, I did not want to run my own firm. I wanted to do exactly what I wanted to do and get paid handsomely for it. And that was just not what it was looking like. And so, you know, I was going to be paid handsomely to do what people were hiring me to do, which was not sort of this merging of entrepreneurship, business strategy, and the law. And so I said, well, what happens if this doesn't really work out? And my dad said, then go take the job that the people want you to do after the fact. And so I stopped the dance of sort of hedging and air quote consulting, and said, okay. And so I came back to New York and I started my firm immediately, but I started with a book of business, which is what I think differentiated my decision from a lot of other people starting a business, particularly a law firm, and not already having a book of business. When I started, I had clients who wanted to work with me. And so that was a game changer. And I also had done, for, you know, better or for worse, when I say my litigation experience was trial by fire, there was very little I had not done. So it wasn't like I spent my time. A lot of corporate litigators, your early stages of your career, you're doing document review, or you're doing, you know, a lot of brief writing or citation, which is fantastic. And it's great for fundamentals, but that's not the business part of running a firm.
Right.
And you need to know how to fish, and you need to know how to cook the fish and catch the fish and eat the fish and sell the fish. Like, you need to be able to do it all.
Yep.
And I had experience doing those things. And so when I made the decision, it wasn't like I was coming in and stumbling. And I remember people would give me stats, 5 years is a big deal and blah, 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 blah. Or they'd look like it was a pet project, or they look like they know a lot of people who've started firms and those people are all broke. And I remember thinking, yeah, that's not my situation. Number one, I don't set out to fail, and I don't have a problem with failure. I think you learn from failure. Mm-hmm. But I know that if I'm executing something, we're going to have success out of it. Now, what that success looks like, will it taste like what I necessarily expected? No, because I feel like God feeds you what you're supposed to have. And sometimes you need your vegetables and not dessert, but I'm going to eat, and I'm going to eat well. And that was my expectation. And I was really blessed that the book of business and the reputation that I had preceding starting the business netted with having been in California and essentially saying, I don't need a middleman to play with the VCs who are there, because now I've already met them. Mm-hmm. And I recognize they don't want to come and babysit no one on the West Coast thinks coming to the East Coast is cool and fun, and they don't want to invest their money here because they like to see their money grow so they can invest in a startup down the street near Sand Hill Lane and feel like they're doing what they want to do without having to get on a 4 or 5 hour flight and leave their family and their life to do it. Now that I knew that, well, you don't have to do it, but you've got a liaison in me and we can do this bad boy together in a lot of different ways. And so that was sort of the structure that led to the firm. And so, yeah, from there, I started the firm. Essentially, in the very beginning, it was two businesses because I wanted to be able to work with people in a variety of capacities. And so the law firm was a separate entity. And then there was an entity called Keiko Global. By name, they're still there, but the law firm ended up being the bread and butter. And so Keiko sort of went under it. Mm-hmm. And that just changed how leadership and management had to be. Because for lawyers, which is why the struggle is so interesting from an entrepreneurial perspective, there are a lot of guidelines and regulations in terms of one, you know, there isn't this allocation of capital. If you're going to have money in your business, you're either earning it or borrowing it, or there's got to be something else.
Right.
But you're not taking on partners unless they're also lawyers. That is changing in some countries. Canada, I think, is looking at it. But the bottom line is, Keiko was to facilitate a different level of management and individuals not feeling like they had to come in and work for me. If in fact they were senior, and that was also what I was looking to do, I felt, or I witnessed how at 65, you know, for a lot of organizations, you're kind of out to pasture, but that may be the time when you've got the greatest brain trust, you've seen it, you know everyone, you're exactly who I want to have coming to work at my firm,
right?
Because you've got the brain trust to do it. And so it was all of those things. And that's when, you know, I put up, in a not a literal sense, I got an office, but you know, I technically put up a shingle and decided I was going to do it, and it's been going for 10 years.
Wow. So boy, so many directions we could go in. Can you talk a little bit about the entertainment angle? I mean, obviously you're in New York, and so just proximity, you're going to be around incredible entertainment talent. You know, it's a hub for that. But what in particular, everything we've heard about so far is corporate litigation and then, you know, sort of basically, you know, West Coast VC, you know, innovation stuff. Where did the entertainment angle come in for you?
New York does not get credit for my entertainment life. That all goes to growing up in Atlanta. So I'm from Atlanta. And I had the great pleasure of growing up in Atlanta in the 90s. And so my entire childhood and teenage years was spent surrounded by individuals who were cutting their teeth and succeeding in the music industry. Now, interestingly enough, I did not stay entrenched in the music industry, but many of them, I'd say almost all of them did, and they did incredibly well. And now are the heads of labels. So it was, and it was a very interesting thing because I think from a parent's perspective, my parents were always, they felt like it was a, you know, a bunch of kids who were almost playing dress up. Like we were all playing dress up, except our dress up netted Grammys. And it was just different. But that was the start. It was a different era. It was a different age. It was the age of LaFace. It was just a whole, and Hitco. And
yep.
It really was a different time period, but those relationships don't disappear. And as I grew up and grew older, I no longer was just friends. I now could provide legal advice.
Right.
And so when I talk about having the book of business, I had seen so much behind the scenes just by nature of being there. I mean, sitting in a recording studio, you witness a lot. And so you know what you like and what you don't like. And then my passion was on the film and television side. So while music was sort of the organic entry into the entertainment industry, film and television was what I was passionate about. And that was different because Atlanta grew into more of a film location, quite frankly, after I left. But I stayed, you know, I'm still very much so involved in the state of Georgia. I won't even say Atlanta. I'll say the state of Georgia is the one who changed their tax. I'm an Atlantan, but Georgia is where the tax initiatives
come in.
And so, you know, that really happened, I'd say, in early 2000s is really where, quite frankly, they just looked at what New Orleans was doing or Louisiana was doing in North Carolina and kind of just changed the laws accordingly. But it was from that exposure, and people leave jobs and positions, but they don't leave their personal relationships. Mm. And entertainment is a relationship-driven industry. And so I was really fortunate to have strong relationships with people who trusted me and whose trust I'd earned. And so as we all meandered through this crazy thing called life, we wanted each other to win. And so we created opportunities for one another. And those opportunities led to introductions beget more introductions, and you know, the punishment for good work is more work. Mm-hmm. And so we took it from there. And my business has been for the past 10 years referral. And so, you know, really great referrals from amazing people. And it's funny because you're tired and things change. But last year I was thrilled that one of my clients, her name is Chelsea Winstonley, and she was the executive producer of Jojo Rabbit, and they were up for several Oscars and did with the film won a few Oscars. But what was amazing is that she's the first Indigenous woman to be nominated.
Wow.
She's out of New Zealand, and it's, you know, between LA and New Zealand. But when we talk about sort of being the first and what those things look like, that matters. You know, I love to see myself reflected. I think that it's now more important than ever to have that diversity of imagery presented. And so being the person who is navigating with clients so that when their time comes, they are able to relish in a win is a gift. And so that's really, you know, that's what it stems from. It stemmed from a long history that traveled with me from a variety of states, and relationships built on trust, and which is very hard. I think once you've decided you want to be in entertainment, you're kind of letting go of those connections because it's so transactional. And so when people feel that they're able to hold on to something real, and you know, I'm a lawyer by profession, but I'm a person and a human, and I have integrity and character. And I'm also I'm brutally honest. Right. And so what people were able to glean was that she will give you the truth. You may not like it. It may not always feel good when you put it on. Sometimes, you know, I'm from the South. Sometimes I try and put a little bit of sugar on it, but sometimes you need to take this bad boy down with no chaser. Like, this is what it is. And when you're making a decision to go into an industry like entertainment, you are, you know, I said this to really one of the best music. She's a Sony artist and a client. And I remember she was worried about a deal. And my quote was, okay, but we've got to understand that we've made choices to swim with sharks. Like, when you are in a certain profession, that is the nature. Those are the parameters. And so we are trying to get the best out of what we've decided to do, which is swim in a messy situation. Mm. And that is, you know, I think that's what politics is right now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you're navigating and really what you want is the best thing for the person and not the best thing for you, and or the best thing for, you know, people who will come in down the line, then people receive that. And I think you net the greatest wins that way. And so that's what brought me to it. It was really, again, those were referrals. I mean, that particular person came as a referral from my friend Natalie. And it was, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about this whole COVID period. And the reality is several referrals from Natalie had some huge significant wins over this period that we were able to construct together, all in entertainment.
Wow. Everybody should have a friend like Natalie. So I wanna wrap by talking about your investment endeavors. And I think it's a good place to wrap because you've had a decade of success running your own law firm, which I think definitely qualifies you to be a mentor which is part of the job, right? For really, really early stage, early money in investors, to the entrepreneurs that they choose to partner with. You've got that experience, and then you've got this broad level of operational experience in a variety of different industries. And then it was great to hear you talk about your client, who was the first Indigenous woman to be nominated for an Oscar, and talk about the importance of seeing everything reflecting the diversity of this world, quite frankly. You know, certainly you as a Black woman, you're looking to see more imagery that reflects you. But I think, you know, we know that this is a diverse world, and we're not seeing enough things that reflect the world, quite frankly. So with that, like, can you talk about where you have navigated to in terms of your efforts as an investor? You know, I think you are likely to be a very unique investor for an entrepreneur to have the opportunity to partner with, given the legal experience, but also being a bona fide entrepreneur. And then finally, you know, being a Black woman. So can you talk about how you've taken that combination of experiences and also passions and executed on that as an investor?
I think that one thing that's interesting is that I don't make my investment choices alone, right? So I make the decision in conjunction with my business partner. And the benefit of that is that we're able to play off of each other. At this stage, I mean, I've had my firm for 10 years. I was practicing for 7 years, you know, prior to that. What I know intuitively is that I know a good thing when I see it. And that's not something that comes from, the correlation is really wisdom, but it's also knowing what, even if it's not big now, what I will want to double down for in the future. Even if I'm not the core audience, if I can identify who is, or, you know, not even I can identify, if the founder can identify who they are, then it'll resonate. I mean, one of the things that I'm a huge proponent of is any sort of venture that incorporates itself into what people do organically. So we know you're going to try, well, not in the era of COVID, but traditionally you wake up, you clean your face, you brush your teeth, you get dressed, and then you go to and from someplace, whether it's your bedroom to your, you know, office, downstairs, your garage, whatever it is. What makes that time frame easier? What is the thing where, oh, I should have thought of that? Those are my favorite things. I'm a fan of products. I'm not so much a fan of applications, unless they really are changing the game and the way I'm doing something. In this era of, you know, remote learning, then I could reconsider my application position. But I think product design and innovation, even if it's not the sexy product design, I can be incredibly, I like smart design. So I was going to say, look, I like a computer chip, that changes the way ATMs are processing money that we can end up having to sell to everyone. I like those types of deals. I can see where the return is going to be, and it just makes sense. It's not the coolest and the sexiest, but it's the revenue generator that pays for all the other investments. One of our most recent, I can say success story, but I mean, and this is an application, but it's a company called Flutterwave. It's out of Nigeria, and they're a payment processor. And what was interesting is my business partner is into fintech. That's his background in a lot of different ways. He's an engineer, but you know, he created Venmo. He has an eye for it. And I remember when he was, or co-created rather, when he was describing why he thought Flutterwave was just a brilliant concept, I was making the relation, okay, so it's a lot like Venmo. And he was like, no, it's better. Like, this is what's happening. And I realized when you talked about the global perspective, what makes it, you know, and not even just Flutterwave, but specifically just talking about them, what makes them this standout is that so much of the world still operates from this Eurocentric positioning, right? Mm-hmm. When they think about what maps look like, they've got this idea that the United States is ginormous and everything else is just
a satellite.
You know, yes, it's just so tiny compared to the US. And then when you look, and I'm like, the continent of Africa is much bigger at scale than what, you know, people are used to seeing on most maps.
Yeah.
And why does that matter? Because people talk about Africa like it's a state, you know, and
right.
versus a continent. They don't even talk about it like a country. They really talk about it like it's, you know, some state. And that matters because Flutterwave can process payments across the continent. And when people were hearing that with, or, and I don't want to, you know, say everyone, but I will say when too many people were hearing that with their very measured and unrealistic view of what that scale and scope looks like in terms of processed payments. And we're talking, and again, we're not talking about uniform currency. We're talking about different currency
yes.
based on where you're located in many instances within the same country on the continent.
Yes.
And so without people having that appreciation, it was kind of like, you know, I'm shrugging my shoulders, like, all right, well, you know, whatever.
Right.
Whereas for individuals who got what they were saying, wait, you're processing all of the payments on the continent of Africa. So if you're Google and you're spending money there, then you've got to go through you. If you're LinkedIn and you're spending money there, you've got to go through you. If you're any entity and you're spending money there, you have to go through you all over the continent. It's kind of a no-brainer. And so that was the decision. And, you know, it ended up being that some very strong VCs agreed, and they did the lead and they did the round. And I mean, now when people read up on Flutterwave, it's a darling of Silicon Valley out of Nigeria, because they are, you know, doing exactly what they said they were going to do. But you needed people who appreciated the scale and what it meant to value what they were saying they were going to do. And to have everyone else recognize it. Like, you don't need an outside person to value the concept, but you need a champion. And so my investment purview is to also champion not just the business, because look, there are some businesses where I will take a step back and I'm not so excited about the business, but I may love the founder. A founder is always going to trump the business. Maybe it's not time for us to invest in that business, but I definitely can double down and invest in you, because this may not be your big win, but I'm confident a big win is going to come from you. And I believe in you and I want to see you succeed. So let's figure out another way to do this. That isn't a capital, you know, a capital allocation in the traditional sense. And for some founders, that's hard, right? Because you just, if you got one more dollar, that's the win. And my hope is that they get that $1, even if it's not from me. But where the founder is phenomenal and in time will either grow into the product, or this product is not for me. I'm not going to want to hear about it. I am not the right investor, because I'm not going to be as passionate as I should be for this to win and for you to utilize me the way you should. But I will be your sounding board, and I will bring, you know, whoever to the table. And again, for a lot of founders, that conversation is always better if you are an investor who's invested in them, because they feel that it strengthens the argument. And in many instances, they're not wrong.
Yeah.
But I right. also recognize that there is a, we are not Greycroft, right? So this is not endless capital. And sadly, with so many, and one, I don't like to paint the picture that VC is the only way you have to go, because I don't believe that that's true.
Yep.
I am a huge fan of the builder capitalist mentality. And so I believe that there are a lot of ways to create revenue and to grow and garner revenue that are the best ways for someone's business.
Hold on a second. When you said, okay, I just have to ask, like, it's the middle of the podcast. I could be totally wrong. The Natalie you're talking about is not Natalie Molina Nina, right?
It most certainly is.
Oh my God. All right, keep going. Nexus is just ridiculous. Keep going.
Natalie is my girl. We have to give a shout out, since you know her. We have to give, Natalie is my girl. That's my ace. Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. So then you already know what my position is.
I do. I completely know your position.
and I don't want to paint this picture like she and I are, like there's this monolith and there's not diversity of opinion, because there definitely is. But when it comes to situations like that and making sure that there is representation at the table, and representation, not just in name, but representation in terms of action and how those voices are heard. Oh my gosh, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's my That's my ace. And so to come full circle, she introduced me to Ariana Afsar, who is who's my client and a friend and a wonderful human being. And Ariana is the person who created the Broadway musical that's on hiatus now, thanks COVID, but for the film named, or for the Broadway show called Jeanette. And Jeanette was essentially, when we're talking about suffragists and the women's movement, that really is a huge part of the story in terms of running for office. So that's the full circle. And she's a Sony artist. So that was the full circle of that. Yeah, yeah. So all of that to say, I believe that there are a lot of ways to have capital and to receive capital for starting businesses. But the most important thing is that we have a diverse group of individuals who are recipients of that capital, and that the knowledge of how one obtains that capital is shared across all spectrums and with a global lens, right? That it's not just you need to play into a US market, because what plays here, it used to be that a huge success here, most certainly in most instances, would net a huge success someplace else, because everyone wanted to emulate the US sort of Western, I hate to say it, but, or a lot of people were seeking to emulate sort of what Western consumers, particularly teens, thought was cool. And so we were trendsetters. That is not the case anymore. We've lost our sense of innovation and imagination in terms of how we educate our students. And when you lose innovation and imagination in our primary years, when you strip our kids of music and even recess or any in art classes and the things that make them innovative, then they're not creating innovative things. We end up making that a privilege instead of a right for young people. Well, most of the things that were cool and that were trendsetting were coming from areas that you've stripped those things out of. And so you're not able to get that cross-cultural success. So we look at who's really winning. K-pop is winning. Yep. And yay, like that's amazing. But that's who's setting the trend, and we then end up emulating. And so when we talk about what that looks like in terms of net business, it's coming, stepping away from our hubris as a US market, whether we are entrepreneurs, founders, or in the C-suite making those decisions, and saying, how will we maintain our ability to lead while acting as leaders? And what does that look like? And I don't think that it stops and starts with just what products we're selling. It also comes from how we're treating the people who are making the products and what gets through the pipeline in the first place. And recognizing that there is value full stop in a variety of diverse ideas. And that's where investment comes from. It's not lost on me that the chips that people love, you know, ended up, what was it? Was it the, was it Flaming Hot Fries that came from the senior custodian at the chip plant? Like, I feel like that's the case. I want to make sure I'm getting the story right, but he's the one who came up with what hot fries would sell, and those are delicious, and he was right. And those, that idea and the ability of knowing what your community likes and the value of it happens at scale across the US, and we just don't hear it because we don't have the people at the table who are able to articulate it in an authentic way. And so that's where the double down comes in. It comes from saying, I want my money to go into amplifying that voice that is saying that all the things that we know to be true, but that just aren't being heard. I only need that breakthrough, right? This one product will do it for a huge array of others. And that's the win. Because once you crack that through, innovation is not lost. It's just being suppressed. And so when we break that out and give people the opportunity to no longer be suppressed, both in business and innovation and imagination and in thought, we all win. And there's money to be made there. I don't want to make, you know, it's there's money to be. You can monetize that. And that's where the business comes in. It's no longer a hobby.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to have to do a part two of this one. But I think that's I think that is a great place to end this particular episode. I want to thank you for, you know, sharing your story and your perspectives. I think that everything you just said is incredibly true, and it's exactly why we need to hear from we need to hear from more diverse people. There's one thing I've learned over the last 4 months in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, and you know, obviously that was not the only thing that led to this moment of more open conversations about racial equity in the United States, and of course that bubbled around the world, you know, because these same conversations are happening everywhere. It is that the people who are in power, because the circles of power have been so homogenous, they really don't know. You know, to your point, they don't have friends that live different lifestyles, or that came from different backgrounds, or even different neighborhoods, even went to different schools. Like, they don't have access, and collectively, we're all losing out. We're losing out on underrepresented intellect that could be making the entire world a better place and making us all a lot more money. So, you know, I think it's great to have you on. Of course, Natalie was the Natalie I was thinking of. She is in many ways the center of many universes. I'm learning quickly. And, you know, look, I hope you'll consider coming back for part two. I want to end here, but I also think there's a lot more to talk about in terms of where the world is going, where innovation is heading. And I think you have a really unique perspective that I just want to explore more.
I would love it.
Awesome. Well, Candace, thanks so much for the show. Any place, any plugs you want to make, you know, before we wrap?
I wish I did. I welcome everyone to join me on social media, on Instagram at Candace1of1 or at CandaceSC1of1 and on Twitter at CandaceSC1. And then pretty soon I'll have a TED Talk coming out, but it's still in the works. So I will circle back and hopefully we can plug that then too.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely be looking for that TED Talk when it comes out. And look, this was awesome. It was so great to have a deep, long conversation with you. And I look forward to the next one.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. And for everybody else out there, until next time, let's build a new normal, y'all. Peace.
Thank you for tuning in to Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.